Good evening, everyone. It is Wednesday night, 7 o'clock here on the west coast of the United States of California. Wait a minute. Where
roughly,
are we?
Something like that.
Roughly, he says. And what we're doing is we're beginning our voyage. We're in the third class of our study of the American Book of the Dead by E.J. Gold. It's an ambitious effort that we're putting together here. Pat's here with us in the studio. And for me, leading us in a certain way, and Ivan has returned from his foreign travels. And he's landed back in the States, and he's with us on camera this evening. So we're looking forward to his description of his adventures and all these things. But before we get to that, what I want to get a sense of is just to get a sense of, are we starting to settle in? Have you had a chance to look at any of the, or listen to any of the other classes?
I listened to last week to a lot of it.
Okay. So on the website, wingsofchaos.com, I post the log and I post a recording of the class if you want to go back and take a look at that. Also, as part of the class, there's a number of opportunities that are arising. One opportunity is we have a special set of pages called The Last Hours of Life. And you're welcome to either send me an email, or as some people have done, they posted it on that page. But then I create a page for each of you. And what it is just a description of what your last hours of life, how you'd like to craft that. And it's just, I believe there are seven up there now, if you have a chance to go look. Just the breadth and the difference that people have done is just something. And there's some beautiful poetry emerging there just by verbally. There's some really wonderful things. But just the practicum of what people said. And Harry, I posted yours. It was very nice. And thanks for posting, sending that up, okay?
Thank you, David. I'm not sure I put it in the right place. So
I created a page for you.
Okay.
All right. So if you go there, you'll see your page. If you'd like to amend what you've put up there, send it to me via email. Send the entire thing so I can take out the old and put in the new.
Okay.
So that starts to build up. So that's part of our work, too. We're working along several different lines at the same time here. We're getting into the book, but at the same time, we're starting to do some practical exercises. And I've been sent by a couple of people, and thank you, the Rebirth Stations, which is Appendix C.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to put that up. And I'm not sure, though, it makes certain sense. I'm actually, right now, it'll be up in a few days, all the Rebirth Stations. Now, the exercise there, and it'll make sense in a few weeks, the exercise there, once again, is you read Appendix C. If you read it and pause as you go through, attempt to not mentate on it. Like, don't figure it out. In a sense, let your attention fall upon it and see what occurs for you. We're going to do that a few times, and then in a few weeks we're going to maybe visit it more directly. And at that time, I'll say why. I think we're ready to get started then. Seems like we're ready to get started. As MC says, yes. I'm just going to open up with a real quick, very short quote. The topic that we're discussing this idea of the moments of our death. What happens when we approach this? What happens at that time? And the literature on it that we're focusing on is the American Book of the Dead by E.J. Gold, who has taken... is taken a text, which is the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and has recrafted it in such a way that it is accessible for us in our Western culture. And it's a moving target, and I'm sure that it may change or not, but it's a tool that some people... how long have you been working with the ABD class? So Pat's been working with the ABD
before it was printed.
Since 1973, which is like more than 5 years, right?
I can't count that
long. It's a big number.
Well, we did the 30th anniversary edition of the book, so
it's a lot. So it's something that she was able to work with for 4 years as a practical tool, and that's the key here. So, but the literature that we're talking about, the literature of death and dying, is a vibrant literature that's been around forever. And I'm going to just... Yeah, you're going
to
get the microphone. I would love it. Well, we'll see what she comes up with. Let her... Give us another couple of minutes.
You can get up there if you want, but I'm going to put a line on if you don't.
Yeah, well, I don't want to crowd them, you know. I want to be with them, but I don't want to crowd them.
Thank you.
Like, is a half? Is a quarter?
Is
3/8?
Don't sit in his lap.
I'm going to 3/8 myself. Don't do anything.
We can share that mic. Should they share that mic? How should that work?
Do you think that you want to share the mic first?
No! But I'm willing to.
Is that okay?
No, I can stick another
mic
on
it.
You don't have to do that. Thank you, Ann. I just am compelled to speak.
Good. Well, you can't see you. You're hidden at the moment.
Oh, no. I'm very visible.
Are you?
Very visible.
We're just...
We're modifying our speech.
Yeah, for the recording, we're adding Pat's now going to join us up on the panel. So we're just taking a couple of extra minutes to plug her in, really is the way it is. So she's now going to be plugged in. While you're doing that, Pat,
yes,
let me read a very brief quote.
Yes,
okay.
I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm ready for it.
And this actually arises from a manuscript in medieval times. So it's very quick, but it's pithy, so listen carefully. Thou shalt understand that it is a science most profitable and passing all other sciences to learn to die. From the book The Craft of Dying by Henry Suso, which was a German mystic. I'm not sure if Germany was actually Germany at the time, but this was about mid-1300s, 14th century. And he was a magnificent mystic at the time. Harry, is that a name you remember? Henry Suso?
Yes.
Of course. So he was one of the prominent Christian mystics that was bountiful during this period of time. And these were individuals that, for me, clearly lived on both sides of the veil. I've talked about that a lot. What I don't want to do, and I want to be careful here, and we talked about this last time, Ivan, you weren't here for this, but I don't want to make this a mythological class that we're pointing to a myth, all right? I want to make it a clear distinction that we're working with the machine and the essential self, and part of what's happening here, and George, just see if I'm on track here, is that this book is going to help us craft those, in a sense, more of a dynamic working relationship. Because we worked our way through human biological machines some couple of years ago. And then we gradually started getting into life in the labyrinth, hidden work, joy of sacrifice. And that was like, I call that, we were seeding the ground of the essential self for it to come out.
Hmm.
Okay? And now, after all this time, this is its place, in a sense. Its record now comes forward, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to start with then is we're going to just start reading this next passage.
Yes, we are.
Okay. And do you guys...
Am I lit up, signed on, mic'd in?
Well, let's go ahead.
She
is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so
we're skipping the how-to.
Yeah, and there's a reason why.
Yeah.
We're skipping this section called how to...
use this.
How to use this book.
Yeah.
Is Star Ananda on? Okay. The how to use this book is a chapter. I don't know if it's actually a chapter out of the Labyrinth Reader's Guide. It doesn't matter. It points to how do I actually do this?
Right.
How do I become what's called a reader? And more importantly, how do I become a professional reader? And I believe that Star Ananda is currently in the midst of a class on that, vigorously working, you know, on Sunday afternoons, is I think that's the time, in Second Life. And if you would go ahead and put that up in the chat.
Put the info up.
Yeah, when it is, and then I don't know how you do.
Some people can reference. You know,
they can reference and go to it in Second Life.
How to proceed with taking a step in that direction if they're...
That's a whole course in itself.
More than one.
And so we're not doing that in this class, okay? Because it is well covered in that class, and we're going to take the ABD and look at it as a different form of a tool, more like Henry Suso is talking about learning this craft.
Which leads us to the very first sentence from the
next
matter called Introduction to the Macro Dimensions of the Labyrinth. And just hold in your mind the repercussions of a word like macro dimensions and labyrinth. Set it aside. Don't come back to it for a year or two, but at least a week or two. And let us step right into the first sentence.
And before we step, I want to remind, there's some people who are new to this class.
Right.
Not just the ABD class, but I mean to
this forum.
Our forum, mm-hmm. that Ivan and I and others have been working with for a few years now. This is what I call, it's a slow reading class. Okay. We're willing to take our time to read slowly, because at the heart of the class is the concept of that we are working together with each other, working together with each other to blend an invocation, and we've seen this over the years. Is this right, Ivan?
Mm-hmm.
And so, we want all of us to join together. So we want everybody to be together in this. So it's not just somebody speaking about it, somebody reading.
Yeah.
We're going to go slowly enough. So please ask the questions. And Harry, I think, is going to help grab those questions for us so we get it on the recording as well.
Yes.
So, Pat,
yes.
I just wanted to just give
Thank
that.
Thank you. And I just wanted to let people know that I will be reading this first sentence three times. The sheer ordinariness of an unprepared experience of the macrodimensional domains of the labyrinth deceives us into complacent acceptance of events. The unsuspecting voyager is unaware any transition. And so, the Tibetans, Navajo, Micronesians, Benin, and other cultural primitives, but macrodimensional sophisticates, have trained themselves through visualization to view all dimensions of the labyrinth, including the human dimension, in a supernormal way.
The sheer ordinariness of an unprepared experience of the macrodimensional domains of the labyrinth leaves us into complacent acceptance of events. The unsuspecting voyager is unaware of any transition. And so the Tibetans, Navajo, Micronesians, Benin, and other cultural primitives but macrodimensional sophisticates have trained themselves through visualization to view all dimensions of the labyrinth, including the human dimension, in a supernormal way.
The sheer ordinariness of an unprepared experience of the macrodimensional domains of the labyrinth deceives us into complacent acceptance of events. The unsuspecting voyager is unaware of any transition. And so the Tibetans, Navajo, Micronesians, Benin, and other cultural primitives, but macrodimensional sophisticates, have trained themselves to visualization to view all dimensions of the labyrinth, including the human dimension, in a supernormal way. So this is a, you know, this is like the header to the book in a sense.
Absolutely.
And he lays it out there. There's a number of points that I think are worth spending a moment on.
Please.
And I want to spend a moment just on a word that's in the middle of the paragraph that it's been something I've been mentioning, and I want to mention again. It says, the voyager is unaware of any transition. And what the author is pointing to here is, he says, there is a moment of transit. Now, let's demonstrate that. We're not going to necessarily get up and do this at the moment, but when you go through from one space through a doorway into another space, in a certain way, you're actually going through from one chamber into another chamber, right? And this is demonstrated pretty clearly in the Practical Work on Self chapter on doorways. Now, there's been a couple of events that occur. You're in one chamber, then you're in another chamber. There's a moment of transit when you are transiting from one chamber to the other chamber. And this is, you know, this is the effort at self-observation. Sometimes I think that the entire work has to do with better and better self-observation and just seeing ourselves in a different way and just deeper and deeper in a different way. So you get into your car. You're outside the car. You get into your car. Now you're in your car, and you're traveling to your destination. And you get out of the car. Now, it's, you can say, oh, yeah, well, yeah, I got out of the car, and then I went to work. But there is an enormous cacophony of electrical change that takes place between those spaces. And what I'm saying is, let's pay attention to that moment of transit, because we're going to need that skill. We're going to need that skill later. So it is what I want to suggest is that you find doorways. The doorway doesn't necessarily have to, of course, be a door. There are these moments of transit all day long. And our sleep is maintained by our lack of observation to that moment of transit. That's a big key for us. We're going to see that, I think, dynamically as we go forward. So, did you ever play the game Zelda? This game Zelda. Did you ever play that? This is a video game. We've played many video games, and it had a really crude way of moving from one to another. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, the screen would just move. And that's when I first started getting the sense of the importance of the moment of transit. Oh. Yeah. So anyway, that to me is a critical point in this paragraph, is that we're talking about something to do with transition. Mm-hmm. Now, the ways and means, we have to craft ways and means for each other. And we craft that by finding technologies, and by this I mean inner technologies, of how to make something like transit part of your everyday life. I remember years ago talking with Path World on?
Yes.
And as she said, I happened to be down in Southern California doing a thing on practical work on self for Coyote's group. Mm-hmm. Brilliant effort down there. Anyway, I got to the doorway upstairs and says, well, I can never remember to do it. This was many, many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And yet for me, it has become part of my work. I've driven it in far enough that when I go through that doorway now, there's this moment of transition that occurs. So it's a technology that we can work with just for that. Anyway, enough on
transit. Terrific.
Very likely.
Do we want to address
one
more point in this paragraph?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. The third of this sentence, the part that begins after the second dash, after the macrodimensional sophisticates, which always sort of catches me. A macrodimensional sophisticate. Ooh, that's something to aspire to. It's like the Fifth Avenue of the Bardos, you know? What you can really feel yourself being competent in the map of dimensions. Anyway, it says, have trained themselves. It doesn't say that they got trained, or that they learned, or that they read about. It says they have trained themselves, which to me is another part of the key that you were giving a moment ago about how everything in fourth way work starts with greater and greater levels of self-observation. The only training that counts is what comes from self-observation. So I just found that it was interesting that in this one sentence it describes what is the problem and how the solution is available if you do two things, become aware of transition and train yourselves to view all dimensions in a super non-way. That's the point that I
That's where we're headed.
Yeah.
That's where we're headed.
Yeah.
Good.
Next.
Ivan.
Okay. Without continuous, well-reinforced visualization training, labyrinthine macro dimensions tend to masquerade as ordinary life. Guides appear, but we explain them to ourselves as simple changes of light playing tricks on the vision. The sweeping tonal harmonics of macro-dimensional sounds we translate to common understandable phenomena, horns of passing traffic, airplanes, music, orchestral, choral, heavily metallic.
Of course, the danger pit there is that this somehow that it is masquerading. We interpret it as masquerading as ordinary life. How do we break that then? Mm-hmm. What do we do? Guides appear, but we explain them to ourselves as simple changes of light, tricks in the vision, sweeping, you know, so on and so forth. Things that, oh yeah. The first thing that we do is we go, oh yeah, I know what that is.
Right. We assume that we
are. Harry, you addressed that a little bit in your team.
David, unfortunately, some of the sound is breaking up for the people that are on the phone. So I didn't hear all of your questions.
Okay, maybe I'm too far away. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay, good. I think I was just...
Pat was also breaking up a little.
Oh, you're too far away from this. And I don't have a way of doing anything with that.
Oh,
anyway.
Project.
The question I was asking you, Harry, is we're talking about this idea of that a macro dimensional effect and how the mind tends to make it into the ordinary.
Right.
In your posting, you said just in this effort itself, you suddenly saw things more brightly.
Yes. I can't hear you now, unfortunately.
Can you hear me?
I heard that. I can see your lips moving, but I cannot hear it on the phone.
On the phone? Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. Well, just keep reminding me. I would appreciate that. I probably have to have that shorter chair next. Okay, thanks for that, Harry.
Do you want to try your question again? Maybe someone else wants to give a shot.
Yeah. I don't think we're quite ready for that. That has to come up. That will come up very, very distinctly. My question is that these events that are occurring that may be macro-dimensional in nature, we tend to translate them into ordinariness. They become ordinary. And so I was just, how does that happen? What do we do? What's the mechanism in which things like that occur? Are we able to notice that event? That's all I'm asking.
Well, I think that we tend to put things in a box right away so that we can compare it to everything else, and that way it just becomes normalized.
Because it's what?
That way it becomes normalized.
Right, it's normalized, understandable, and we can grasp it. We're not frightened.
And
David,
then,
excuse me, go ahead.
I was just going to say, since we don't have a box for that, we have to put it into some other normal box that we know of.
Or we don't. And that's the work, I think, before us in the ABD, and I think something we've talked a lot about over the years, Susan, too, is that the machine tends to do that. The question is can we pause and hold open and stand in this sweet spot of wonder that I call and allow us to see differently?
Give us an example of something that is this being heard by them, or do I need to sit?
No, I think you're being heard by the computer,
but not
by the phone. But I'll repeat.
I'm going to give an example.
No, you don't need to do that.
Of something that occurred this week for me.
So Pat's saying that she's giving an example of something that occurred this week for her.
That reminds me of the style of lessons that EJ teaches around this subject.
And it reminds her of the style of teaching that EJ uses along this subject.
I have a voice teacher that comes twice a year from Germany.
So there's a voice teacher that comes twice a year from Germany.
And this lesson that I had on Monday described something in a new way for me.
And during her Monday lesson, something was described to her in a new way.
And it pertains to the use of the language that's in this sentence where it says, without continuous, well-reinforced visualization training.
And it brought to mind for her this very concept of the visualization training. That
well-reinforced
visualization
training. And I've always heard the word visualization and assumed that meant my eyesight.
So here's a good point. So Pat's saying that she had heard the word visualization and assumed that it meant her eyesight.
And in my voice lesson,
nice.
My teacher described the aiming for a pitch that was between two points without stretching for it.
So in this particular case, in her voice lesson, the teacher indicated aim between these two points in her voice, using her voice, and then without stretching for it, right?
Yes. And the way he held up his fingers on either side of his visual parameters.
And so he held up his fingers in such a way as visual parameters.
Which reminded me of the changing or diffuse state or some of those other types of exercises we do with our sight, with our vision.
So that reminded her of some of the diffused vision techniques and I have the diffuse vision exercise. I'll post it on the ABD site.
And he's describing something that has to do with sound.
So now he's describing this event. This has to do with sound.
And he's showing me with his fingers, and it is actually an exercise strictly of attention and following where something leads. I mean, it's extremely precise. And when I read this sentence tonight, I understood what continuous well-reinforced visualization training means, at least in part?
I think that, like any other skill, that you can become better and better and better at it. And this is such a skill.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a practice. It is a definite gradation of practice.
Good.
And it is a development of a skill. And the skill allows a level of building that includes additional development. That's this meaning. Continuous, well-reinforced visualization training. It's a loaded phrase.
It's a very loaded phrase.
Yeah.
And that's the invitation before us, I think, in the ABD, is that we're invited to begin this training. Now, and this is the part I want to be very careful about, because I don't want, I don't want it to become new agey in the sense of it's out there.
Yeah.
There's this kind of sensing, and we'll get into this in a lot more detail as we go forward, but this kind of sensing requires a particular kind of rudder and knowing how to move and how to utilize that rudder. We begin to discuss in the hidden work material.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get into that a lot more during the course of this, but it requires each of us to do work. It requires each of us to put in this sustained training.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see this back and forth between the way the machine works and the opportunity of using a different set of eyes and beginning to see things in a labyrinthine manner. The word labyrinth, of course, is a construct. I mean, it's just a word. But it's a good construct. It's got enough poetic depth to it, I believe, to explain what we're talking about here. We're not saying that there's, some... Like, for instance, Pathworld has a labyrinth that people walk, and that's, there's a whole tradition of English labyrinths and other labyrinths walking. We're not talking about that type of a thing, but just that as a noun, it's labyrinthine, or would that be an adjective?
Yeah.
More of an adjective, that this kind of voyage is labyrinthine. And we want to train ourselves to be there, train ourselves in a different way, and we have to do something different, don't we?
Absolutely.
Don't we have to do something different? If we want something to be different, then we shall do something different. Otherwise, guess what?
Same, same.
You bet, baby.
David,
and then in the next, go ahead, Harry.
Simon Templar asks, could Pat give it a try again on her explanation or new understanding about what is visualization in this context?
Okay. In the phone people, why don't you turn up your computers or just if you near your computer, because I can't do the...
Right.
I can hear her fine.
On your computer or on your phone?
On both. On the phone.
Pardon?
On the phone as well.
Oh.
Several people are reporting that it breaks up, David, on the phone. Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
We're going to do our best. Pat, it's an important enough topic that if you want to take another shot at it.
And I wouldn't mind.
And should that mic be closer to her?
Well,
is that it?
That mic doesn't.
Okay.
I can sit where Ivan is and speak.
Yeah, do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And did he ask me if I could? Yes, I can.
And I'm asking you if you would.
And I will.
Thank you.
There you go.
My voice lesson on Monday was with an instructor I see twice a year, comes from Germany. And he was describing a specific type of sound that he wanted to have me make during the exercise. And the way he described how to make the sound was, he actually held his hands up on either side of his face as if he was putting his fingers slightly out of view, you know, as we do in that visualization, diffused vision exercise. And he had his fingers pointing in a way that reminded me of this exercise, which, of course, you know, is an exercise I do frequently. And he described how he wished to have me make the sounds in the exercise by reaching each of the two sounds at either end of the spectrum, but not by reaching for them, not by going for them, by allowing them to be both touched. I'm not going to get into the specifics about the musical event, but his description of how the exercise verbally, visually, and musically taught me that the use of the word visualization does not necessarily have anything to do with using my eyesight. It has to do with an understanding about what is required to make the effort. He was describing how to proceed with a specific type of effort that we were making to produce a certain quality of sound. And in this sentence where it says, well reinforced, continuous visualization training, I have the sense of the necessity for extreme precision and small, deliberate practice. Very fine practice, small practice, building on each other. That was my point. Did you hear?
Yes.
And Simon, does that help out a little bit? He's on another continent.
Yeah,
everybody on the chat room, David, says that it's much better.
Excellent. Good. Yeah. This two points, Pat, that I want to emphasize. One, we're going to need to use the mechanism we call sensing. That has to become a more prominent tool for us. We are always in the mode of sensing. Most of the time our sensing is quiet and we don't pay attention to it. But it's on. And I'm saying let's bring that up. Once again, it's self-observation and actively starting to work with it. Okay? Now the exactitude part. I had the opportunity to be in certain spaces several times where the exactitude of movement within these spaces was just thoroughly demonstrated to me. The specific, it was geometric.
Very good word.
So, can we get there? The answer is yes. How we get there, we're starting to develop the dialogue on how to get there, and we're putting in place a couple of techniques on how to do it. This idea of transit, okay? The doorway exercise from practical work on self. I don't remember the chapter at the moment, but a practical work on self, the doorway exercise, and this focus on transit, because these particular types of things occur, you don't know when they're going to occur.
No.
I remember sitting in a years ago when the You'll remember this, Margaret, when the kitchen was
where the dining,
room is now, and then the dining room is where the kitchen is.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big lunch there. We're sitting in lunch, and it was a casual lunch, and at that particular moment, there wasn't anything of note going on. EJ wasn't talking or giving a talk or anything like that. But all of a sudden, the space changed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The space changed. I looked up, and at that moment, EJ looked up, as did one other person, at the exact same moment, and noted that change in the space. By which I mean, George, the vibratory sensation was different. Not necessarily more intense, but had a different tonality to it.
Sometimes referred to as atmospherics.
The atmospherics, that particular one had a particular floral sense to it that I recall. This was 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So anyway, so can we be exact? The answer is yes. How do we get exact? By practice. Someone was saying to me, I was on the phone with them, they said that their hands are glued to their steering wheel. That's their job. They're just constantly at the church of the white line on the highway, which is enormous discipline if you do that. It's quite something. And, you know, how do you, and this person can do this particular job because they've done it a lot,
mm-hmm.
and they've done it well. That's the only way to do it. We do things over and over and over again because we can hone our skills. Now I'm saying, this is this book here, the next chapter in a sense of where we've been working the last few years, is offering us the opportunity to say, okay, now here's where you can go.
Mm-hmm.
If you're serious and you the machine is awake and you understand how to awaken the machine and you work with that, and now what? Well, the essential self is actually starting to come alive just a little bit, and it's getting. The balance between the two is actually starting to be noticeable. At that point, you need another manual.
Hmm.
This is that manual.
Yeah. A guide.
We need a guide, that's right.
A guidebook.
So, go ahead.
The mind transforms labyrinth phenomena into ordinary phenomena of the present consciousness. Remember that the nature of the phenomenal world, the lower dimensions, is phenomena. All the phenomena of the organic world, the human dimension, as well as the labyrinth with its macro dimensions, are controlled by the being attention, because higher mind controls itself, unlike lower mind, which is controlled by the environment. But unfortunately, the awareness of an individual generally doesn't include awareness of or control over the mind. Really much to say about that, because you guys have been covering this for years now.
Yeah.
So really, it's the next paragraph that clues us in. May I?
Yeah, keep going.
What is called the mind in ordinary intercultural translations of higher ideas is simply the result of the activities of the primary attention of the being the cosmic nature of which is voidness, which is called in this treatise the essential self, that which is one's own, the deepest self, existing only temporarily dependently upon the biological self. I love that sentence,
yeah.
By the way. Puts everything in the proper perspective.
And it sets the tone for a disturbing question.
Okay.
You know, we take on these individual bodies, right? For some reason, we've selected the particular ones that some of you can see, these three, for some reason.
Do you see three?
I'm just saying these three is what they see on the camera. What I'm saying is that we've taken that on, and then we go forward. But don't forget the title of the original, the Bardo Todol, or the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the original title is Great Liberation Through Hearing in the Bardos.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty weird if you ask me. Because, I mean, how do you get liberated through hearing? What is that all about? Okay? There's something about hearing, and then how does a dead person hear? Okay? So this doesn't make sense to me. So
okay.
You're going to have to explain some of this to me, Pat, as we go along. So it's great liberation through hearing in the Bardos. Anyway, so...
Are you going to leave that for now?
That's a question I'm posing to the group.
Good.
I'm not... I was running through some mental pictures of that.
Pose the question again, and just reformulate that question in a manner which everybody will take that question in, at least for, you know, I would say a minute a day, but I would like it to be more like... Why didn't you give it 20 minutes? That's a third of an hour. Give yourself 20 minutes with the question, which is, there is a liberation which occurs by means of hearing in the Bardo.
Part of the, we haven't really talked about this over the years, but in a sense, for me, the ABD poses the first issue for us as students,
mm-hmm.
and that we haven't had before, is that it will take a particular form of, for lack of a better word, and I'm going to use it anyways, a form of meditation, that we're going to need to be with our essential selves a bit. There should be a discipline of meditation, and it'll help us to begin to see this great dynamic between the two. We were given this, you know, we always, you know, the Christians, in which I am raised in that, is the sin, you know, all the sins of the body and all this stuff. I almost brought the Book of Revelation, by the way. I was
mm-hmm.
reading that this afternoon,
mm-hmm.
but I refrained from bringing it. But it's just this whole idea of, you know, we're blessed with this opportunity to have a body, because
mm-hmm.
then we can do something. And one of the things that we can do is we have a struggle that is set up with the very existence that we came upon, and that has something to do with our own personal karmic wins.
Mm-hmm.
And karma, the karmic doesn't occur because, you know, you robbed the bank or you ran over that little dog or whatever it is. That's not, those might be karmic acts, or you stole your parents' money or something like that, whatever you might have done. And I do know some of those events. But it has to do, the karma that is the moment-to-moment mentation that is occurring in our little gossipy minds all the time. That's the karma that we're dancing with as our day unfolds, we'll need some of that information as we get further into the book itself. But we're the sons and daughters of our own karma. Okay, I'm not quite sure where I got there, how I got there, but go ahead. Yes. That is reinforcing our karma all the time. You know, when I'm sitting there, I'm thinking about my next-door neighbor, you know, and why isn't she more considerate of me? And did I mention the me part? I don't think I did.
I haven't heard it yet. Go ahead.
Yeah, that it was me that I was more, I just can't quite get why I wasn't included in her thoughts.
Exactly.
Much, much more.
Yes.
But no. So when I'm chattering on about like that, when I'm doing whatever I'm doing, I'm creating a karmic vector at that point.
Oh, very nice.
Okay. And that...
Bring in the physics of it, why don't you?
No, I'm not going to go there, because I don't have the talent to do it, but it's we're working with energetics in that manner. So that's what I'm saying, Marvette, is that that's what I mean by we're... And the more we pay into it, we're paying into this bank. Even in the 1640s, when Spinoza was creating the ethics, which I will be referring to often.
Thank you.
And, you know, even at the beginning when he wrote the short treatise, which he didn't complete, he converted into the ethics later. But in the short treatise, he goes, here are these desires of men, you know, this money and lust and so on, and pleasure. And he says, but then there's this other thing he calls a clarity of mind, and where he winds up going. But he says, where you go is where do you put your money in a sense? Where do you deposit?
Mm-hmm.
What are you depositing into?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when I'm chewing away in my brain there about my neighbor, guess what?
And that's what's going to be sitting in your bank.
That's going to be sitting in my bank, and as long as that's in my bank, particularly if I'm not paying attention to it, that's where the karmic wind is going to start taking me.
Take you down that road.
And so when we read this quote by Henry Suso at the beginning, thou shalt understand that it is a science most profitable in passing all other sciences for to learn to die. So these guys, when they're talking about this stuff, they're not talking about just, you know, the death point. They're talking about having the vision to see the whole pattern at the same time. So if that's where my karma is going to take me, then where do I want to put my nickels and dimes every moment? Every moment.
In every moment. So I'm just going to remind us that in the center of that particular sentence that I just read, which was technically about mind, it says, the cosmic nature of which is voidness, the primary attention of the being, the cosmic nature of which is voidness. And for me, that's always the clue. Always the clue.
Always the clue to what?
It's always the clue that if you will allow your understanding or perception or whatever it is to include the aspect that it is voidness, then you have a better chance of not stepping through in the same old way.
So you might want to take... So there's now building up several homework assignments.
Oh, that's
one,
right.
One is one that you've just mentioned about this strange clause, you know, like how liberate, great liberation,
liberation,
he says,
in the bardo.
Through hearing in the bardos, you know, where are the ears? And that's one, you know, we're talking, and maybe you should do a little, you should work with meditation a little bit in that regard.
Yeah, just sit with it for 20 minutes.
And then, given the light, given what we've talked about this particular hour and the last time, I would like to suggest that you read the Clear Light Prayer. Okay? Read the Clear Light Prayer at some point and see what happens now that we're starting to get a little context.
And if you do not have a clue as to where it is reading number 4 called Confronting the Clear Light.
And
we sometimes refer to it as that Clear Light Prayer.
And where is, which page is that on?
That is page 77 in the
Red Book here.
Red Book. It's the 25-year book version. But anyway, it's in the first stage of the voyage.
So the Clear Light Prayer.
Reading number 4.
And then do the exercise about the last hours of life. And then finally, without thinking about it, scan the rebirth stations.
Nice hefty.
Yeah, but they're just merging is what's happening. Yeah. They're merging.
Yeah, hefty.
Harry, do we have any other comments that rolled over everything?
Actually, we don't have very many at all. There's only there are no more questions. I don't see. And there is a statement from Simon that the dead must be hearing from the other realm.
Okay, the dead must be hearing from the other realm.
That is a very good way.
Really well put, Simon. Thank you.
There is another question. Basra, does the ABD tell us how to hear, how the higher mind can be more active in the day-to-day living room?
If I understand that question correctly, you're asking if the ABD tells you how the higher mind can be more active in the day-to-day living. Is that what you said?
Yes, that's correct.
Delve into that question.
Yeah.
Question to address.
Botha hasn't given any further clarification to the question.
Yeah, and I've been saying that that's part of our task in this book is to answer that particular question.
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's significant. It's very significant for us.
Scafuni has added that it is through non-identification, I think.
Okay.
I'm just thinking that What's very profound to me about this book is, and the Bardo Jodal, let's say, coming from the Tibetan and some other traditions, is that it is meant to be implied when I get up in the morning and when I walk out of my house, I go to work, drive my car, it's the great liberation by hearing, it's not only for people dying, it's not only for me when I'm out of body, Voyager,
yeah.
And also for tomorrow morning.
Yeah, so it's not, Ivan's telling us that it's not just for doing the readings for the dead, but it's also, and you really do see this in the literature, it's for our day-to-day practices. It's for tomorrow morning when I get up.
It's about a way of life.
It's a way of life.
To prepare for dying is also about a way of life.
It's a way of life. Go ahead.
David, sometimes when I read for others, and particularly after I sense they've already chosen or left, I'll read something that seems particularly poignant and applied to me in my everyday living, and that will kind of repeat itself throughout the day. So I think we are reading for ourselves every time we read for others.
Yes, we are. And we'll have many pragmatic stories about that over the next few months here.
if I may just add one little touch to the answering of this question for who is posing the question?
Batra.
Batra. If you recall the first sentence here in the introduction, it says, the sheer ordinariness of an unprepared experience, including the human dimension. So the Bardos are not discluding the human dimension. The human dimension is included in the Bardos, and therefore all aspects of the teaching are relevant in all dimensions, including the human dimension. The ABD is
right.
Not only relevant for the daily life of the human dimension, it is involved in the daily life of all dimensions.
That's right.
So you just put it in, you know.
So part of what we're doing.
Ingest.
To expand on what Ivan was saying and what you're bringing up now, is how do I stand in that viewpoint?
Yes.
How do I stand in the viewpoint where what Ivan was saying so poetically, so perfectly, really? No, it's like
you
said, it's for tomorrow.
For tomorrow, when I get up
in
the morning.
When I get up in the morning. So that takes practice, and we're going to practice it together. And the best way to practice it together is to either ask questions, leave comments, things like that. That helps all of us move forward. So we're just a little bit over time.
Oh, okay.
Is there time for Judy here to make a comment?
Judy here,
please.
Okay, if we go to page 26 at the bottom where he says, between lives of reincarnation, like a flat stone on water into the voidness of non-creation. So we're like this flat stone, and it just continues to have a concept of just this continuance, and we take on a body, and then we continue after the body. And if on page 27, if son of a bitch got me again, when we come back and really haven't, you know, realized who we are or what we are. And the best way for me that I really got a full sense of this, there's a book by Maurice Nicole called Living Time, and he talks about recurrence rather than reincarnation. So for anybody that would be interested, that really gives you a sense of what this is.
Yeah.
So I'll just put the name of the book in the chat box.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Yes.
Page 30. In the 25th edition.
In the 25th anniversary edition,
okay.
It's on page 30, yeah.
Great. So thanks, everybody. Thanks again. Thank you both for making it this evening.
Thank you, David.
And we'll look forward to seeing you next week, same time, different day, I guess, huh?
It's all voidness.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Thank you.